Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we are chatting with Australian security researcher Nick Kubilovich. He's been doing some fascinating research into using OSINT techniques to obtain market-sensitive information. It's OSINT for fun and profit. That is this week's feature interview. In this week's sponsor interview, we chat with Marco Slaviero, who is the lead researcher from Thinxt Applied Research. Thinxt is, of course, the company behind Canary.Tools, the affordable must-buy security tech of 2016. Seriously, stop what you're doing and buy Canary. But anyway, Marco is along this week to talk about some free services and tools that Thinxt has developed. You may have heard Haroon Mir talking about honey tokens on a previous episode. Well, the team at Thinxt have done some new work on honey tokens. They're using Microsoft's crypto API to do all sorts of really, really funky stuff. You'll love this. It's an interesting approach from a really talented group of people. And Marco Slaviero will be along to talk about that in this week's sponsor interview. But first, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, this first story, you know, I think if there was a comedy award for like the company that gave the most in 2016, already you would be working pretty hard. And I know we're only just at the start of June, but you would have to work pretty hard to beat Symantec at this point.
They certainly have done a few boneheaded things this year, although this one, man, the optics on this are just really not very good. Symantec, in their role as VeriSign, the most trusted certificate authority on the internet or something like that, issued an intermediate CA signing cert to Bluecoat, vendor of, amongst other things, man-in-the-middling SSL equipment used by dictators and jerks and corporates everywhere to man-in-the-middle people's traffic. Now, that's not a good thing. And the response to that also hasn't gone particularly well for them, which is, dear, oh dear. But yes, they gave Bluecoat a CA cert. Like, what were they thinking?
Yeah, I mean, you just think, like, how could you be this clueless and not realize that making a company that makes SSL interception equipment, making them an intermediate CA, kind of not really what people would want you to do there, guys. But I got to ask, like, what has the response been?
There's been a bit of hand-wringing about it, I guess, and Symantec have come out and said, well, this is a thing we do for lots of people, which is true, they do. You can just go get a CA cert off many of the certification authorities, and the way that they do it typically is that they don't give you the private key for the cert. Like, they generate you a signing cert, and then you log into some interface managed by them to issue certificates signed by your intermediate CA so that you don't have to go through the palaver of paying them, $300 million for every piece of cryptographic material they generate for you. So you pay them, $400 million, and then you get essentially a flat rate kind of thing to be able to mint your own certs. And this process, because you don't have the private key, Symantec does, is meant to be, subject to more oversight. So they can see what certs you've issued.
Yeah, so if you go around issuing certs for things like Facebook.com, Gmail.com, they can see it.
That's the assumption, is that they would ever look. And, of course, we don't expect that they ever would. There are some constraints. Like, there's technical processes you can go through to generate an intermediate cert that it actually isn't valid for signing. So, you could say give Bluecoat an intermediate CA certificate that says this is only valid to sign star.bluecoat.com. And then, in theory, if the certificate, constraint infrastructure worked, then they wouldn't actually be able to use that certificate, and that would be the right control. Unfortunately, that process doesn't work because, everyone's implementations of actually checking that are broken. OpenSSL, for example, has been broken forever. They know about it. They haven't got around to fixing it yet. I think Chrome and Firefox do actually check it correctly, but, other implementations just don't.
Basically, if we boil this down, Bluecoat do not have the power. They're not going out there issuing themselves certificates that browsers will accept for common websites so that they can use them in their interception gear. It doesn't appear that that's what's happened here.
No, they claim they are using it for internal testing, but there is no technical reason they couldn't just go and ask for a certificate for Facebook.com, and we are relying entirely on Symantec's oversight to prevent that, which I guess is the situation we're already in.
Yeah.
Because Semantic can issue those certs anyway. But I just think
So can DigiNota and Komodo and about a million other people, right? So I think it is kind of normal. But I mean, you know, the concerning thing, I guess, was that, you know, Bluecoat had cooked up some sort of deal to be able to get these things to plug into their SSL gear. And, you know, thankfully, it looks like that was not the case.
Yeah, it does appear that is not what has happened. Although I do think Semantic's response, like one of the things their spokesperson said was, we're talking about the way that the Bluecoat uses a certificate. They said, what the certificate does not give them the ability to do is to issue public certificates to other organizations, Gideon said. That's the big misunderstanding. And that's absolutely not the biggest misunderstanding at all. That is not the thing we are suggesting that Bluecoat's going to do, sell certs to people. No, of course. And that, I think, just kind of, you know, is the fact that you know, the fact that they are responding to entirely the wrong issue really doesn't fill me with confidence.
Look, we're going to move on to you know, this type of story that crops up every couple of years. Armed FBI agents have gone after this guy, some guy who reported some bugs involving like dental records or something really like, you know, not credit cardy or something. But this guy apparently reported a bunch of bugs. The next thing you know, the FBI is kicking his door in.
Yeah, this guy was a IT technician in the dental medical area, and he logged into the FTP server of some dental software vendor as, you know, like anonymous to go get updates or whatever, and found a whole bunch of medical records knocking around their anonymous FTP server, reported it to them. And then, yeah, a dozen FBI agents rolled up at his house, kicked his door in. Well, okay, they knocked on his door and then presumably invited themselves in with guns and stuff without any other suggestion that he had done anything other than, you know, kind of report it to the vendor in a responsible manner. Clearly, the vendor doesn't understand how the world works. And, you know, now this guy is facing charges under the CFFA. And it's all a big mess. So it doesn't, I don't know what they're thinking. You know, I mean, there's the one thing of rolling in with guns for something which is clearly not a violent offense. And then the whole other thing of, you know, responsible disclosure. And then next minute you're being arrested.
Yeah, it's a multi-layer fail, this one. And I'll be very surprised if it does actually go to court. But if it does, I mean, we might see some meaningful reform, because this is clearly, clearly ridiculous that this guy would actually be charged for doing the right thing. So let's hope the vendor sees sense. Let's hope the FBI sees some sense. Let's hope everyone just sees some sense.
That would be nice.
Now, we had some excellent research out of Duo Security, which they were doing embargoed briefings on this the last couple of weeks, so I kind of knew it was coming. This is where they've looked at all of the rubbish software that ships with HP, Dell, Acer, Lenovo, and Asus computers. And yeah, of course, all of this rubbish where, you know, these tools that ship with their computers are, of course, full of security vulnerabilities and awful, awful, awful things that you should not have on your computers. Surprising, absolutely no one, but it's nice to see Duo do a fairly comprehensive write-up of this.
Yeah, no, it is. It is a very good comprehensive write-up and collection of the various different ways you can break it. And if you're, you know, looking at reviewing corporate desktop and laptop security builds, then this would be a table well worth having a look at, because it does describe all the various methods that they've used. And yeah, it's well written up, well arranged. You know, there's some amusement in it, I guess. Like Lenovo actually has two separate update agents, one of which is the best that Duo looked at and the other is the worst. So that's nice. Good, consistent work from there from Lenovo.
You should put him in a VM and watch them fight.
I suppose that the icing on this particular cloud, to mix my metaphors, is that at least the crapware that they ship on OEM laptops, at least they have updaters these days. Like it used to be in the old days, they would ship crapware that they couldn't update that was broken. Now they're shipping crapware that they can update with an updater that is also broken, which, you know, that's an improvement.
Yeah, it's fantastic. They've got an updater which don't do things like, you know, signature validation and things like that. Yeah, awesome, guys. Okay, well done. Swift has introduced two-factor auth to banks right now. Now, the funny thing is, when I first saw this headline, I had this, like, almost out of body flashback to the first time you and I spoke about Swift, you know, going on a month ago now, where you came up with the immortal line, your security controls don't do what you think they do. And yes, as I read this headline, I heard your voice just floating through the recesses of my mind.
For most people, their security controls don't do what they think that they do. Those controls don't provide the level of assurance that you think that they do.
What do you think of this, Adam?
Well, I mean, clearly two-factor auth is better than what they got at the moment, which is one-factor auth. Obviously, it's not really going to address the full gamut of problems that they face. But kicking and screaming into the year, 2007 AD or whenever it was that two-factor started being a thing. I guess that's an improvement.
But, yeah, it is. But I mean, you got to wonder, like, where are they going to implement it, right? And could a man, a man in browser attack, if you're dealing with a web application gateway thing for Swift, I mean, it's going to do nothing in that situation. This is not going to kick the can down the road very far, especially when you're dealing with a bunch of adversaries who we know have gotten away scot-free with tens of millions of dollars. I mean, they're going to have time and development resources to get around your 2FA.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, in my day-to-day work, I regularly get around 2FA, and it is not a, it takes a little while. It adds an extra, a few days to your life on a job or something. But no, it really doesn't, there are a lot of things you have to get right for this to be effective, and I don't know that the kind of model that they operate in is really a good place to start from. Yeah, as you said, these attackers are clearly well-financed and know what they're doing. And this is, it's a small step.
Yes, baby steps. Apparently 12 more banks have fallen victim to what is presumably the same crew. And I say that because everyone seems to be getting their hands on the malware used in the attack. And what I don't like, though, is companies like FireEye and BAE and I think Symantec as well, all saying, oh, it's the same crew that did Sony and a bunch of other stuff. They're linked to North Korea. It's North Korea because there was some common malware used between these attacks. The only reason I felt comfortable with the attribution in the Sony case is because it came from the NSA, right? And they, indirectly through leaks, right? But they're the type of organization that I kind of trust more with that sort of attribution over, say, BAE Systems.
Well, yeah, clearly there are some motivations there in terms of selling more, crappy software, security software and services to people. But no, I mean, the idea that it's the North Koreans funding their nuclear program, of course, does make for good headlines. But whether or not that is the case, yeah, we will see about that, I think.
I mean, have you looked at these attribution claims? I mean, what's your thought on them? Because it just seems pretty flimsy to go, oh, yeah, they use the same, hard drive erasure technique that those guys used. Therefore, it must be them.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, it is pretty flimsy. I mean, I guess I haven't seen the full set of available evidence. Like, there may be some things that are stronger ties, but that kind of attribution, is at best flimsy, and at worst downright disingenuous.
I mean, the reason I trust the NSA to make that call is because they're all up in the North Korean guy's shit, right? So they're gonna watch them as they do it,
Although the other thing that's interesting about the Swift story this week that is we have seen some more data come out of Swift about some of these other 12 banks that have been compromised. It includes at least ANZ out of Australia and an unnamed New Zealand bank, so that's nice and close to home. And for all our local banking listeners, hi, how you doing?
Yeah. A whole bunch more of people's creds are out there. Apparently MySpace, Tumblr and Fling. I've never even heard of Fling.
Troy Hunt is talking up something like 300 million unique records showing up in the underground recently from breaches going back a few years. But it seems to be the same guy selling them on the same forums. And he's getting good feedback apparently in the forums.
There you go.
So, that does indicate that the data is perhaps good. But, obviously these kind of lists have knocked around on the underground for a long time, and seeing them all kind of bodged into one list, it does start to look like rather a lot of people's passwords. But they're all password one, right? So, I mean, how many times do you need to see that, eh?
Ah, now here's a bit of interesting exploitation, Adam. This one looks quite badass.
Yeah, this is a really interesting write-up, actually. So some guys have been working on combining the Rowhammer kind of physical memory attack with using memory deduplication as a side channel for inferring contents of memory. So if you're running a virtual machine, a number of virtual machines on modern systems, often they will share memory pages that have the same values between virtual machines. So if you're running three copies of Windows, you don't have to have three copies of the kernel in memory. You can have one copy and kind of share it. To leak data between virtual machines, these researchers have come up with a way where they will write to a particular memory page, and if that memory page was previously shared, i.e., some other machine had that same block of RAM in it, and you write to it, it has to make a copy to store your changes in, and that copy is detectable as a timing side channel. So you can use that to infer, you know, interesting things about the contents of RAM. And by doing that a bunch of times, you can kind of leak data between machines, which is quite a cunning attack. And then combining that with Rowhammer to flip bits in the main memory that you've leaked the contents of, you can do quite targeted attacks. And apparently they've got this working from inside a browser, which is, you know, itself quite an interesting achievement. So yeah, really, really, quite cunning combination of tricks, and, you know, sort of quite hard to defend against for many of the reasons that we have talked about with Rowhammer. But yeah, using, you know, combining an infraleak with a Rowhammer style bit flipping thing really does make for quite a powerful attack primitive. And yeah, interesting research.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a little bit different to ringing someone up and convincing them to turn on TeamViewer, you know, but it's like, it gets the job done. I mean, this is skinning a cat with lasers. I love it. It's, it's cool. And there's I'm linking to a register piece in this week's show notes, and from there you can go on and find papers and all sorts of good stuff. Andy Greenberg has an interesting write-up on Wired about hardware backdoors.
This is based on some research coming out of the University of Michigan about hardware backdoors. And the thing that I think is novel about this one, or different, is that it's an analog backdoor on the chip, and so it's really very, very small. The idea is they bleed off a little bit of current from certain parts of the chip and kind of use the accumulation of that current to trigger a bit flip or to trigger a change in behavior somewhere else in the chip. And by very carefully kind of planting where you put that, you can have a very, very small, you know, minimally invasive backdoor that you can still trigger and use to, you know, escalate privilege or do something else. So it's and they actually built the hardware to demo it, which is, you know, it's not just sort of a thought exercise. So that's quite cool.
Moving on to this one, another one from the register, and Pornhub, the porno site, they've revamped their bug bounty because, you know, they launched one that really looked suspiciously like a bit of a publicity stunt. And of course, they got swamped with bugs. They didn't pay enough. They were locking people out when they shouldn't have been. Like, it's been collecting a bit of Twitter heat, you know, social media heat, and a few headlines over the last few weeks. But apparently now they've seen the error of their ways, and they are overhauling their program. And I think it looks like they're in a bit of damage control at this point.
Yeah, so it looks like they have seen some of the errors of their ways and have gone back and apparently are crediting some of the previous bug reporters with a bit more money, and they've hired some more people to work on triaging the bugs and all that sort of things. But, you know, I guess, you know, sites like this, of course, have very large user base visiting them and, you know, have many of the same problems that other websites have. So I guess, the fact they are taking this seriously now, even if it was, you know, it did seem a bit stunty, as you said earlier on, you know, maybe they will get some good bug reports. I know I saw Snare submitted a bug report, so good work him. I hope he got fat bank for that. But yeah, I'm sure they you know, improving the quality of their engineering as a result.
Moving on to this piece from ThreatPost, and this is hilarious. Some crews out there are just going around breaking into enterprise networks, and instead of like encrypting stuff and, you know, demanding a ransom, they're kind of dressing up their intrusions as altruism and saying, hey, give us $30,000 and we'll show you how we did this awesome pen test on your network, which, guys, it's not really how it works, but they're giving it a red hot go anyway.
Yeah, no, back in the old days, I think we used to call this extortion, and now it's called like unsolicited bug bounties or something. But yeah, this is obviously a thing that hackers once did in the 90s, and it went very badly for everybody. And it would be really great if you didn't do this. But yeah, clearly people are, and maybe some people are paying. You know, maybe it's cheaper than a regular pen test, even if you didn't commission it and authorize it in advance.
It's a new approach. You know, we've got bug bounties coming along, different engagement model. This is different yet again. It's innovation.
Proactive bug bounty.
Proactive bug bounty. That's right. Surprise red team, but you still get the bill at the end. The former US Attorney General Eric Holder did a podcast interview recently where he said that Edward Snowden performed a public service by triggering debate over surveillance. They were interesting comments. I kind of feel like people have amped that up a little bit too much, because he also said, you know, in the same breath that he still thinks Snowden should go to prison. But, you know, so I don't think he's really was saying that the leaks were a justified public service, but he certainly acknowledged the positive elements of the outcome here.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to see him saying that, and it's nice to see that he is a sensible person who can reason about things in a sensible way. but yeah, it doesn't make for any real exoneration of Snowden, as I mean, Snowden pointed out in response that, you know, the charges that he would face under the Espionage Act in the US don't actually allow for a public service or a public interest defense anyway. So it's kind of irrelevant from that perspective. I mean, it would make no difference whether or not this was indeed the case, you know, whether he was acting in the public interest or not under the laws they would charge him. So a bit, kind of hollow in that sense. But yes, it has been rather spun up to be more than perhaps Eric Holder meant.
Well, it's like occasionally when Edward Snowden says he'll come back to America if he can get a free fair trial, and, you know, the like journalist who hasn't heard him say that a million other times thinks that it's news and writes it up. You know what I mean? It's like, it feels like one of those situations. A group of researchers have done just a little bit of an interesting web front end to some data from NGOs that track attacks against activists and things. And they put it on a pretty map and, you know, generated some nice tables so you can see what type of people, what groups of people get owned where and by what.
Yeah, and that certainly is a sort of gives you a better idea of who is doing the owning, sort of as by reverse attribution, by seeing who is getting compromised, and, you know, the fact that lots of Tibetan activists are getting hacked in India. Gee, I wonder who could be behind that. Kind of does provide some good data. So, you know, it's nice to see this aggregated and as something that you can point to when you are having, you know, discussions about, you know, the nature of surveillance technology or the nature of the use of exploits, you know, for this kind of thing. I'm sure many Twitter debates will be informed by this.
This is hilarious. German cops apparently just went and busted some guy and fined him for buying weed off Silk Road. Like, you know, it's years ago that he did this, and he just copped like 3,000 euros in fines for like buying weed.
Yeah, and not even a lot of weed, like a very modest amount of for personal use only of weed.
Not that you and I would know what a moderate amount of weed is or what a huge amount is. We have no frame of reference at all, and we have no idea.
None whatsoever.
But yeah, like bugger all, like not much at all.
Hardly any, actually. Very, very reasonable. And yeah, they don't even have the weed, because I mean, it was years ago. He's probably, you know, thrown it in the bin by now, or whatever else you do with weed. And they're prosecuting him for, you know, the act of being in the records of someone who sold weed on the Silk Road. And presumably there's some other corroboration as well. But yeah, I guess if you bought weed in Germany off the Silk Road, you know, 5 years ago, maybe you want to, I don't know, move house.
Maybe you'll be expecting a fine in the mail soon. Krebs on security. He's just published a story here that has an interesting data point, which he very conveniently put in the headline. Windows O-Day, going rate these days is 90K in the underground, which is kind of interesting, right? It is interesting to see people pay that sort of money in the criminal world, because there was a time when that was regarded as being, you know, nation state cash and kind of out of the reach of criminals. So it is interesting to see underground forums going, yeah, I've got Windows O-Day, 90 grand, who wants it, you know?
Yeah, but I was surprised actually to see that it was that much. And this is a Windows local privisk, admittedly across apparently 2K through to all the way to fully patched 10 with EMET, et cetera, et cetera. So clearly a very good local privisk bug. But yeah, I was surprised to see 90K for that. I would have thought it would be a bit less. I mean, if you reported that to Microsoft for a bug bounty, you know, you might get that kind of money, actually. I mean, you know, especially for a one that across that many versions of Windows. But yeah, I mean, as you say, this is what used to be kind of, you know, Gruck scale nation state cash, as opposed to just, you know, Windows bugs being flogged on some Russian forum. I mean, I think the last Windows local we bought was like 5K, not 90, and that worked just fine. So, yeah, right. I don't know, maybe someone's overpaying somewhere, I don't know.
Well, Adam, that is actually it for this week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we will chat to you again next week.
You will indeed. Talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Moving on, and it's time for this week's feature interview now with Nick Kubalovich. You might recognize Nick's name. It does come up every now and then. Most recently, Nick was all over the internet because of an epic blog post that he wrote that became the go-to resource on the Craig Wright / Satoshi situation. Adam and I actually spoke about that post on the show some time ago in the news segment. It sort of turned into an updated, like, wiki-like blog post, a monster post. But Nick was at OSCERT last week presenting some research that he's done that's actually pretty interesting. I recorded this interview a few weeks back, but it got bumped because I got sucked into the crypto wars thing. But yeah, I'm happy I can run it this week because it is very interesting stuff. Basically, Nick has spent a bunch of time researching how to use OSINT, open source intelligence techniques, to distill market-sensitive information from data obtained over the internet. The idea being that you can use internet tricks to figure out metrics about companies that other people might not necessarily be privy to. Now, if you get good enough at these sorts of techniques, the idea is you can trade on the information and make stacks of cash. Here's Nick Kubalovich.
So the way I got interested in it, I've been following the financial markets loosely, specifically an interest in hedge funds and trading. Did some trading myself for a period, and I found out about this whole field of market intelligence, which is where you have traders who are paying large sums of money for research reports, where they get tech companies to crawl up data in various ways that they can use as an edge in their trading. And the most interesting example that I heard about that was eye-opening was a company called Gentech, I think it is. Genscape. What they do is every quarter they rent out a fleet of helicopters with infrared cameras on them, and they fly them over oil pipelines and oil storage tankers in Texas region of the States, and they figure out how full the storage tankers are, and based on that they make an assessment to what the oil supply is for that quarter and the sort of correlation that has to the price.
Well, I mean, I've loved these types of examples, right? Because I always thought that it would be an idea to, you know, ring up the pubs in agricultural towns and ask them how much beer they're selling and see if the movement in the volume of beer sales actually correlates to some sort of, you know, successful yield is more beer or something like that. I mean, there are all of these types of indicators, aren't there? Warren Buffett, one of his favorites is to look at the total tonnage of rail freight in the United States as a leading indicator. Infrared helicopters, all of this, but there's other ways.
Yeah, so there's all these things you can measure and then deduce tradable information on it. So the Wall Street Journal ended up writing an article. I think it was called something like Traders Seek an Edge with High-Tech Snooping or something along those lines, where they profiled a whole series of these techniques. And they went from everything from using satellite imagery to count the number of cars in car parks at retailers to figure out what their foot traffic was like, through to, you know, pulling iPhones off of Apple stores and noting down the serial numbers and figuring out what the sales orders are. And then, you know, there was a company that had something like 800 remote antennas with video cameras counting the number of rail cars that were delivering, you know, all sorts of different commodities. So it was just like a completely fascinating field.
And so I take it from that, you got the idea of, hey, what sort of similar information gathering can I do on the internet?
Yeah, the one thing that was in common with all of these was it was all real-world data collection. So they were going by and, you know, counting physical cars, counting rail cars, counting storage tankers. And we've got a lot of tech companies where the main hit or miss target on their quarterly results is based around software that they use or distribute. So, for instance, Google has, you know, search traffic. Adobe has Creative Cloud customers. So, you know, is this being done with web-based resources using open source intelligence or other things that we know in the security field?
So what was the first thing you looked at?
It sort of came about a bit over time. I mean, it's just something that was sitting in the back of my mind. I didn't really sit down one day and decide to work on it. It was just like the pieces sort of loosely start coming together. One thing that I realized in doing InfoSec work is that the OSINT part of it is the beginning of a project. And a lot of that data, it's valuable in terms of building up to your target, but on its own, it isn't valuable. And there was one project in particular, which I can't really talk about. And some of the data that I collected at that point, working on that project, I thought, you know, this has got value here in this case in terms of getting to the target, but it also has value in terms of trading on their financial information. And what it was specifically about was figuring out the net addresses that they owned. And it was like a whole bunch of IP addresses with a whole bunch of live servers. And that was telling a story that was very different to what the public perception of the story was at the time. So somebody in InfoSec might have used that as part of their sort of broader work, in targeting them in a pen test or whatever. But it and it wasn't that interesting or valuable. But in the financial world, that information had a lot more value. So it sort of started coming together bit by bit.
So if you footprint a big financial institution and you start seeing domain names popping up for which obviously hint at new service lines and things like that, I mean, that is market sensitive information. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, that's the sort of thing. And then also, you know, the number of servers they're running and then finding things like, you know, brute forcing the DNS space and finding hosts that they've set up that indicate new products that they might be releasing, you know, that they've got more servers than what the public thinks they might have for the number of users they have. And, you know, here's an interesting example. In terms of figuring out how many users someone has, you know, if you've got a really common name, you notice sometimes if you sign up to a brand new service, the username John might be available. But if it's a mildly popular service, you might need to use, you know, John Smith as your name. But if it's an even more popular service, you might need to use, you know, John Smith 1980 as your name. And so taking that data set, if you figure out which usernames are available and which ones aren't, you can then deduce just using some statistics how large their user base might be. And then, you know, you can then use that number and then go and trade on it if that's a number that, you know, might move the stock.
Well, I mean, my favorite one is looking at the number of Adobe Creative Cloud users by enumerating. I mean, it's possible to enumerate how many new users they've signed up by looking at their usage of AWS. Is that right?
Yeah, so they were using SimpleDB on their back end. So when you created a user account, you got a 64-bit number as your user ID that was used on the back end services. So what I did is I, you know, requested 10 user accounts, figured out what the scope was, and then just sat down and made a whole bunch of web requests. Had to say, for instance, you know, 100,000 web requests, 500 of them were hits today, and then, you know, you work backwards and figure out what the user size is. Do it again 2 months later, you might get 510 hits. So that might mean, you know, that they've signed 4 million users in those last 3 months. The analysis projection could be, you know, Adobe's on track to add 2 million users while you know that they're going to add 4.5. So they're going to beat their expectations, which means that, you know, you trade the stock long.
Now, here's the most important question. Did you actually backtest any of this, or did you actually trade on this information and actually put your money where your mouth is?
I did. I paper traded some of it and I real traded some of it as well. And I ended up in a situation now where I've got a basket of 7 stocks that I've traded for 6 months, and the results of that are going to be in my paper and in the presentation next week. But, you know, I definitely beat hedge funds on average, which isn't a bragging point anymore. I mean, I think hedge funds are down something like 30%. But, yeah, it performed really well. I'd like to do a bigger sample over a longer period of time, and I'd like to get some more expertise on the trading side. But I think fundamentally the concept's been proven pretty well.
Come on, Nick. Did you come out ahead?
I did, actually. I came out ahead on paper more than what I did in real life. But
that's always the way, right? Look at this new algorithm I developed. I backtested it and I'm a millionaire. And then you put exactly, it live, yeah, and it's like, oh, shit, okay. Drinks are on you, pal.
Well, it's funny. In one of the cases, I actually traded for real before – you know, I sort of did anything else just as a way to sort of put some skin in the game and to sort of force myself to work on it. And one of those trades ended up working out really well, actually. So there's that. And then, you know, through that process, I sort of just refined things a bit and worked on it a bit more. And I think now it's at the point where it's working pretty well, but I mean, there's still a lot of work to do. And as that, you know, and part of going public now with it is to sort of hopefully find some people to collaborate with on this project and figure out some of the more complicated trading-based stuff.
So if you disappear from the InfoSec scene and we see you driving around in a Lambo, we know you've been successful. Is that, I mean, that's the question. Like, why are you doing this? Is this actually, okay, it started off as a curiosity, but are you actually going to pursue this as a strategy for your own sort of personal wealth generation?
I don't know. That's a good question. So during the course of working on this, I was reading a bunch of financial blogs. So I actually did reach out to people to talk about them. The first thing, which is what you mentioned, is this seems so obvious. Like, why hasn't anybody done it before? So
they probably are, right?
Well, they are. The answer is that they are, but nobody really talks about it publicly. So that's the thing with these hedge funds is they come up with these strategies internally and they work on this stuff and they profit from them. And, you know, they're not doing conference talks or anything like that. So, yeah, I did find some cases of similar things happening or, you know, even exact things happening, and spoke to a number of people. And, you know, I got a couple of, I wouldn't say offers, but, you know, interest from a couple of hedge fund guys to work with them on this more full time. But at the moment, I'm sort of just more curious on the research aspect, and then, you know, I'll figure the rest out later.
Do you think this is something that companies need to really think about in terms of perhaps concealing or obfuscating some of this data that they're inadvertently leaking that can give away stuff? Is this something they should really take steps against?
So at first, I sort of ran through the process of thinking about what it looks like from the company's perspective that they might not care. But it turns out that they should care, and they should take defensive measures, because the guidance that their CFO set is really important in terms of what the stock's going to do. And so a lot of these companies, they have employees who are invested through option schemes and whatnot, and they don't want to see their stock moving about due to speculation from, you know, external forces. So they probably want to close off as much of this as possible and try and prevent it. So one of the lessons, I guess, is that most companies, they look at, you know, primarily security, like more explicit security vulnerabilities like SQL injections and everything else that we've known to come and love. But there's this, you know, field of information disclosure, which previously might not have been a big deal, but might become more of a big deal, considering that, you know, a lot of that information can be used to trade their stock on.
Okay, so we've got three examples that you've mentioned. We've got username, you know, JohnSmith125, you know, and using some statistical tricks to infer from increases in specific username numbers, maybe growth in a user base. Then you've got looking at AWS ranges to determine Adobe signups. That's also really cool. And then you've got the footprinting stuff that you did at the beginning, which I imagine, you know, you bust out Multigo, you know, do some DNS tricks, and you're like, oh, this hints at a whole bunch of new products and services. There are three specific examples. Can you think of any others that people should just be aware of in terms of, you know, OWASP's got their top 10. What are Nick's top five?
So the other one is that APIs expose a lot of information. So if you're providing developers a way to hook into your systems, a lot of times those systems have IDs associated with fields as well. So Facebook is actually cognizant of this, and they made some changes where they've scoped their user IDs per application so that you don't share user IDs across different API users. And then now they're doing it with all their other resources as well. So user Ray that signs up to their API and starts requesting data will get a different set of IDs than what user B does. And it turns out, you know, a lot of these APIs who aren't Facebook, who have already considered this, but they've done it for, you know, privacy reasons and all sorts of other reasons, that you can get a lot of data out of that. And then just making a whole bunch of requests to these API endpoints and start plotting some data. You know, a couple of examples like some of the online advertising markets and tracking cost per click and then deducing sort of demand from that. You know, you can pull all that information out from the API as well. So these API endpoints, they're providing a way into the very core of your business. So you just got to be wary of, you know, what exactly you're handing over, and if you can obfuscate some of that internal information and provide like an alternative namespace / scope where users can access that data. And the last one is, a lot of these techniques require acquiring a large amount of data from the system. So endpoints such as, you know, which username is required, exposed IDs. The classic one is you see order increments at the end of URLs. So a lot of these web frameworks, they default to creating databases where it's an order increment field. And we've known in security for a while that these are dangerous in terms of the information they expose. But it's so simple just to add a one to the end of a URL, keep requesting it until you find the end of the range. And that's, you know, there's been a trend with NoSQL databases to use larger IDs and to sort of have a random range. But there are still a hell of a lot of applications out there where not only can you determine the number of users, but you can determine the number of almost any record because the ID is just a simple sequential number.
Nick, that's all really, really interesting stuff. But you know, you've been all over the internets and all over the Twitters recently because of your sort of hobby of debunking Craig Wright. And you know, it would be remiss of me to have you on the program and not ask you for your thoughts on all of that, because Yeah, I mean, you were writing some very big blog posts and taking a lot of, I would have to say, some pretty serious legal risks with some of the things that you were saying about the man. Have you heard from his lawyers yet?
Unfortunately, no. I'm looking forward to it. I was thinking of putting my postal address up on the website just so they know where to send the legal demands to, because I don't think my address is listed anywhere. I wanted to help him out a bit. But, you know, I'd look forward to that. I'd look forward to the opportunity of challenging Craig Wright's claims wherever he wants to challenge them. I'd be happy to receive a lawsuit from him or his law firm.
Because, I mean, we spoke about this like a week or two ago. We were having a chat via Twitter and I said, aren't you worried you're getting sued? And you said, no, actually, I'd really like it if he sued me, because then I'd get to go to court and we could have a fun old time with that, proving what's real and what isn't.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I don't think it's going to happen. If it does, I look forward to it. I think, you know, for a while there, I felt very alone, is that I was the only person treating his claims from the viewpoint of assuming that they're false. But it turns out that a lot of people were skeptical as well, which, you know, I'm eternally grateful for. But I'm surprised by a number of very respectable people who seem to have fallen into his trap and are, you know, breathing life into his claims. So the sooner we can debunk all this, the better it will be for everyone.
Nick Kubrilovich, thank you very much for joining us on the program to have a bit of a chat about your research into financial OSINT, market-sensitive OSINT. We've got to come up with a cool word for this.
Sure. Between now and next time, we'll have definitions for all this, and Gartner would have written a report on it.
That's right. Thanks a lot for joining us to explain it, and best of luck doing the conference circuit with it.
Thanks, Patrick. Cheers.
That was Nick Kubrilovich there with a chat about market-sensitive OSINT techniques. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Marco Slaviero, lead researcher with Thinxt Applied Research. Thinxt is, of course, the company behind the Canary Tools honeypot devices. Now, you have heard me say it time and time again. If you are responsible for the security of a medium to large-sized network and haven't already had a look at these things, do drop everything and do it now. In terms of value for each dollar spent, you cannot spend any better money than dropping $5,000 on some canaries. But yeah, Thinxt is the type of company that just can't stop doing interesting stuff. Marco and his colleagues, Asar Desai and Nick Rohrbeck, have been working on a new approach to honey tokens. Some time ago, you would have heard Haroon Mir on the show talking about honey tokens. These are little things like URLs and domain names that you can sprinkle through your data, and if anyone like clicks on them or does a domain name lookup on them, you get an alert. They're little tokens that can tell you if someone outside your organization is accessing your data. Well, Thinxt have come up with an amazingly refreshing approach to the good old-fashioned web bug. You remember people would embed images and stuff in Word documents to see a callback if someone else opened them? Well, that doesn't really work so well anymore. So these guys have figured out how to use Microsoft's Crypto API's OCSP, like revocation checking, to breathe new life into the humble web bug. They've also figured out how to use Crypto API to notify you when certain binaries are run on your production boxes. It's typical Thinxt research, very lateral thinking done well. Oh, and there's some good news here as well. You can generate all of these honey tokens for free using Thinxt's tools. Here to tell us all about it is Marco Slaviero.
So the Crypto API is interesting because it gets reused in a bunch of places on Windows. And we're aware of it being used in at least two places. The one is AuthentiCode uses it to verify signed executables, and Office uses it to verify signed Word documents. And those are two completely different areas of Windows. On the one hand, you've got documents. The other one, you've got the whole executable system. And so both of those use Crypto API to verify when those individual files, executables, and Office documents have been signed by some entity. The Crypto API uses OCSP to check whether a certificate's been revoked or not. And part of the checks that OCSP does, it hits a URL as part of its the whole stack of checks that it does. And so what we can do is insert a canary token into that URL, and we can either make it a web URL, or we can just insert the token into the hostname part of the the URL. Essentially, we've got two types of tokens we can use. But the upshot of it is when the certificate is checked, Crypto API will try and hit this URL, and we'll get a notification to say that unique URL and there was an access attempt for it. And so from that, we can infer that the executable was run, if this is an authentic code executable, or if this is an office document, we can infer that the office document was opened. So what is interesting about this is that we don't need to use valid certificate authorities. We can create a completely fake certificate authority, create a certificate authority, sign a certificate, use that certificate to sign the executable, and Crypto API will still call out to the URL, even though it knows nothing about the certificate authority.
The whole point of Crypto API is that you can do it yourself, though, isn't it?
Right. And you don't get, so for the signed executables, there's no notification that a signature check has failed. So the signature check, in fact, is valid, but it's the checking for any revoked certificates that will time out. In Office documents, you'll get that little ribbon at the top to say that there was an issue with the signature. But, I mean, it's the kind of thing that often gets ignored anyway, and it's a minuscule warning.
Well, now, I can see why this is useful, right? So I'm thinking, I'm a network defender. I get a bunch of Word documents or Excel files or whatever. I do this to them, and then I sprinkle them all throughout my network, right? So I've already got myself some canaries, which are sitting there waiting to chirp. But, you know, maybe I want to actually have some of this on my production servers as well. So I go, you know, I go create a share called HR, or actually put it into the actual HR directory, the HR file shares. You know, everyone's pay.xls or everyone's W-2 forms dot whatever, right? And then if someone steals that, if they open it and they're stupid enough to do that when they're online, it goes out and checks to make sure that the certificate that signed that document is valid. And then I know that that document is somewhere on the outside of my enterprise. That seems to be the idea, right?
Yeah, that's the idea. So for us, tokens are one part of a defense. So we don't see them as a replacement of sort of more traditional defensive attempts. But the thing that tokens gets you is agentless detection. So it's super quick to deploy a token onto a server. It's literally drop a file. You don't have to install additional software. You don't have to install some kind of central monitoring thing. It's take this file, generate it on our website, stick it on your on a server, and wait for it to let you know. So yeah, we would see it as scatter these things through your org. And then you wait for them to let you know when they've been accessed, opened, or something like that.
Now, when it comes to the executables, I can't really see that you'd be wanting to use these things to see if they get run outside of your organization. But I'm guessing that what you're going to do with these is, well, I'm not guessing because you told me in your email before we started this, but you can create things like ipconfig.exe or net.exe or whoami.exe. The idea being that if someone gets on that server and runs them, you have a log that those commands were run from your box, and it can send you an alert, a pretty high quality signal.
Right. So, I mean, and I think in there you'd take a server that's pretty stable. You're not going to get people accessing it frequently. And so when you do see, or if someone does run whoami.exe, you consider that to be an event worth investigating. And in that case, something like a signed Canary Tokens executable file gives you exactly that without having to install any agents or any endpoint stuff, any additional endpoint stuff on that particular server. So you make that executable, you can sign one of the typical executables that an attacker would run when they get access to that server, and then wait for them to run it, and you get your alert.
So what, you just go into the guts of Windows and then sign it as per the instructions on your website, and then it's all set up to alert as a canary through, as a token through your infrastructure?
Yeah, so I mean, we've made this, or part of our view on how defense goes is that implementation matters, and the idea for tokens in general is quite an old one. And I mean, it goes back at least to 94 with Tripwire, but what we do with tokens in particular is we make it really easy for you to deploy the stuff. So you would take whoami.exe, you upload it to the Canary Tokens site, and it immediately will give you a signed version of the same exe back. And at the same time, you would provide an email address where you would get your alert. So you replace your old whoami.exe with a signed one, and that's it. You're done. like there's a pretty big thing there, which is you're taking executable code from us and putting it on your own servers, which would probably be raising flags for a bunch of people. And we're fully aware of that. So for us, the solution that we've got there is Tokens is fully open source. And we also make Docker images available so you can deploy this easily yourself. So you can verify and run your own infrastructure without having to give us your executable code and then trusting what we send back to you.
So is this a service that you're charging for? Because I know that the Honey Token stuff initially was just set up as a bit of a fun, free project. And the idea was eventually that you were going to integrate this stuff with the Canary tools. But where's that at? Where's, you know, is this something that anyone can do for free now through you guys?
Yeah, it's completely free. So in fact, it's still on our roadmap for Canary tools. And that's getting attention as we speak. But the development, as we see it at this point, is on the open source side. So we put in all our effort into the free stuff, and we are going to be integrating it in the coming months to put it into Canary Tools. So yeah, it's completely free, and there's no features that would be only available to paying customers at all. At the moment, this is a free service that we do. And we've been playing with it now for about a year and a half. So like for us, it's also moving past the point where it's just sort of a fun thing we do on the side. We really think that this idea of agentless detection has got some merit. So we're chasing it pretty hard.
How long have these particular ones been around, these this crypto style one? How long have you actually been offering them, and have you had any success stories from them?
So the crypto one is really recent. And in fact, like I should give two, I should separate here. So we've got the signed executables, which just went in last week. So we're still waiting for those war stories. In terms of the signed documents, that's not yet integrated. For that, we've essentially got proof of concept code that we're playing with internally. But like the original work there comes from a Russian guy, Alexei Chirin. And so for him, it's also sort of proof of concept work. So we don't have war stories on the signed stuff. We're still waiting for those. But I mean, in terms of tokens in general, is getting there certainly are war stories. We're aware of people who've discovered intrusions through tokened office documents, not using the signing technique, but using sort of a standard web bug technique. We know of local privacy activists who make use of tokens to try and detect when they're being surveilled. And at this point, they haven't been surveilled as far as they can tell.
They really are hoping, though, aren't they? They hope that one day they can prove that the government is watching them, that they are important enough to be under surveillance.
In some sense, they almost express a bit of disappointment that they haven't yet figured out they're being surveilled.
I'm curious too, like this is, you guys have been going nuts with the honeypot stuff with Canary Tools. This is something where you guys have a little bit of competition. I mean, I don't think it's, you know, I know of a couple of other vendors doing kind of similar stuff that doesn't seem that good, to be honest. But are you also seeing other people playing around with tokens, other vendors, or is it just you guys? Because, you know, on one hand, it's good to be the only company doing something. But on the other hand, it's almost nice when some, you know, idiot behemoth like Symantec comes along and validates your approach.
I mean, there are people who are... So the idea of tokens in general is, as I said, not a new one. And for us, implementation matters. Like I know Dell put out work recently on Active Directory credentials, which I thought was useful work to look at. And that's sort of in a similar line to what we're doing with tokens. But in that instance, the work is research grade and it's specifically focused on Active Directory credentials. Our take on this is that anywhere we scratch, anywhere we look, we're going to find scope for new tokens. So like we've got thoughts on how we can take this and not just on sort of local servers on desktops or even local machines, but how you can tokenize services or you know cloud-based services, things you would find that don't exist on individual locations but exist as these broad offerings from these big vendors and sort of take that and see where can we find the opportunity for tokens in that space. So we think this idea of tokens has got lots of scope. And in terms of other people doing the same, I'm not aware of people who do it to the same scale that we're doing it in terms of targeting a wide array of places that you can find tokens. But I'd love to see if there were.
Okay, Marco Slaviero, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about the latest work you guys have been doing with Honey Tokens. It's very interesting stuff. And of course, we, you know, as much as we'd like to think that all of the attackers who are stealing our documents are smart enough to open them offline, we know they're not going to. So I suspect a lot more war stories next time we speak. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
That was Marco Slaviero there. Big thanks to Thinks Applied Research for its support of the Risky Business podcast. And as I have said a million times, go buy their stuff. And I'm not even saying that semi-sarcastically like I do sometimes. Buy it for real. And that's it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.